Hello, everybody. This is Elsie Wolf Black, and I'm sitting here at the Northwestern College Center for Service Learning. I will let him introduce himself.
Hello, my name is Dave Wilkins. I'm a Lumbee Indian from North Carolina. I am presently at the University of Minnesota. I teach in American Indian Studies, and I have appointments in political science and law and American Studies.
What has inspired you to do that kind of work today?
Bangalore inspired me. When I was a college freshman, 1972, I took a course on American Indian religions, and I read Vine's Custer Died for Your Sins for the first time, and that was a watershed book. It just opened my mind to the possibilities, to the humor, to the strength, to the vitality and the validity of our peoples. And it really did just pry open my mind, and I said, I want to know more. I need to learn more. And so that summer, I began to hitchhike up and down the East Coast, looking to meet other Native peoples, wanting to learn more about Indian treaties, Indian law, Indian women, but just learning as much as I could about other Native peoples. I had been a military brat. My father was in the Army for 25 years, and I'd been raised and born on reservations, military reservations. But he had retired in 1968 when we moved back to North Carolina. And I just went through junior high and then high school. But nothing really clicked until I started college and I read Custer. And that was the beginning. Well, after I read Custer, I continued to want to read other Native authors. I had never read any Indian authors up to that point. And then I began to realize that Scott Momaday had written Housemaid of Dawn, and I began to look for other Indian authors. And it was just really inspirational. And so, like I said, I continued to travel, continued to hitchhike every summer. And in the summer of my junior year, a group came down from Akwesasne, the Mohawk Nation in New York State. They were traveling back then throughout the Western Hemisphere. They had a van, and they called it the White Roots of Peace. And their job was to just literally travel like I had been doing on my own, meeting other Native peoples, trying to make connections. Because this is when all the AIM activism was taking place, and there were lots of activist periods occurring. Alcatraz had been in 69. You had the Trail of Broken Treaties in 1972, Wounded Knee in 1973. So lots of things were just sort of coming together. And so I was just coming of age at that very moment. And so it was just a perfect sort of perfect storm in a positive way for me to have all that sort of come together. And when I met the White Roots of Peace folks, they came through my hometown and they invited me to do my first sweat lodge. And that was another, mine was the political and legal awakening in my brain. And that sweat lodge was a spiritual awakening for me. And so the combination of those two different forces sort of colliding in my mind and my heart convinced me that this is the way that I want to continue for the rest of my life. And so I did that, and then they invited me to go up to New York State that summer and work on the newspaper. At that time, they published a newspaper called Akwesasne Notes, which was the best Indian newspaper in the hemisphere at the time. And I went up there, and while I was there, I met lots of other Native peoples. And actually, I met a guy who was a Monacan Indian from Virginia who had been adopted by the Lakota people. And so he invited me back to his place at the end of the summer. So I had one more year of college, and I went to his place and spent the last month, and we did lots of sweats. His home was just about 20 miles north of Washington, D.C., and so various Sioux delegations that were coming to Washington would come to his place, do ceremonies, get their minds right before they went into D.C. to talk about treaties, to talk about policies and laws and statutes. And so it was just a perfect opportunity for me to just be exposed to lots of other Native peoples. And so that's why when I began to learn more about the Lakota ways as well, and those folks all knew about Vine's work because he was there, sort of political and legal leader as well. And so I didn't want to go back to school. I had one more year left, and I said, that's it, I'm dropping out. I just want to do this. And that guy said, no, you got to go back. Finish. You got one more year. You know, we're going to be here. The issues aren't going away anytime soon. Go get your degree. You'll need it somewhere down the road. So it was good advice, and I'm glad I did it. So I went back and sort of muscled my way through my senior year, even though I was really, had already moved on intellectually, but I finished. And then when I finished, it was 1976, and again, I was continuing my travels. And yeah, I just did odd jobs just to raise enough money to travel, just so I could meet, continue my explorations of the Indian world. And then in 1979, I met a woman who knew Vine really well, Helen Shearback, who had worked in D.C. for years. And she said that Vine had just started a program at the University of Arizona, a master's degree in federal Indian policy. And I said, geez, that's what I've been waiting for. And she said, well, I'll introduce you to him. So I didn't really know that she knew Vine, because I knew what Vine was like up here. And she said, well, I'll let him know you're interested, and he'll get in touch with you. I said, sure, yeah. And sure enough, a week later, I'm sitting at my work. I was working as an apprentice at the Department of Archives and History in Raleigh. And I get this call, and I pick up the phone. I said, hello, is this Mr. Wilkins? I said, yes, who is this? This is Vine DeLauria Jr. I said, really? He said, well, who the hell do you think it would be? And so he just began to describe the program that he had set up. And it's exactly what I'd been waiting for, unbeknownst to me. He said, well, are you going to come to Tucson or what? I said, you better believe it. So that summer, or I had to take a couple of courses in political science because I didn't have any background in poli-sci. I took two courses in political science at North Carolina State University. I took the GRE exam. I failed it miserably. But fortunately, I had a good GPA, and I had good people to write letters of recommendation. And I got accepted into the program in Tucson. And that summer, I went to a Sundance in South Dakota, and I took a bus down to Tucson. And that's when I began my relationship with Vine and studying under him, and got my master's there in 2 years. Met the woman who would become my wife, who's a Navajo. And we got married the year we both graduated. She got her BA in elementary ed. I got my master's. There she is. And then Vine and I had just forged a really good relationship. And he tried to talk me into continuing for the PhD, but I needed a break from school. And so I said, I need a break. And then he connected me back with a woman, Helen Shearback, who had introduced me to Vine. So she hired me back in Virginia. I moved back to Virginia and worked with her organization, which was right outside of D.C., that worked with non-recognized tribes along the Atlantic seaboard. And I did that for a year, and then her funding ran out, and by then my wife was homesick. She said, let's move back to Arizona. So we hopped in our Dodge Dart and drove back out west. And I stopped by to visit a friend at Navajo Community College, which was the first tribal college like this one. And he hired me on the spot. And so that's how I became an accidental teacher. I taught there for 3 years. And then finally I realized I needed to get that final degree. I needed a PhD or a law degree. And so I began to have conversations with Vine and with my friends and relatives. And Vine said, well, we don't need any more lawyers. We got a lot of them, and they're screwing things up. Even though law was good, don't get me wrong. We need some more historians, but we have some of those. But we have nobody studying politics. Why don't you get a degree in politics and you'll be able to get a job anywhere? Good advice. So by then I was homesick, so I wanted to go back to North Carolina. So I applied and Chapel Hill accepted me. And I moved back in 1986 with my wife and my young 2-year-old son, just like yours. And I began my PhD. I finished that up in 1990. Vine left Tucson and moved up to Colorado the year before I graduated. That opened up a teaching position back in that department. So then they hired me. So I was back in Arizona in 1990. And I started teaching there. Taught there for 9 years until 1999, when the desert finally ground us down to dust. And we decided we needed to move. And so we moved up to Minnesota, where we've been ever since.
And how long have you been in Minnesota?
Since almost, going on 10 years now.
Oh,
We never meant to stay there that long. My dream was always to get back to North Carolina and become the first full professor at Chapel Hill. They've never had a full native full professor there. And they actually offered me a job about 5 years ago, and we were this close to moving. But when push came to shove, I said, I want you to hire some more people who look like me. And they said, no, we only want to hire one of you. And I said, I don't want to be alone, you know, on a campus this size. I need some colleagues. And they wouldn't do that. And in Minnesota, I have colleagues. You know, we've got a nice, strong Indian Studies department, which makes a big difference. So I said, well, I'll stay here. And so we've stayed. But we're anxious to, we're not anxious, but we're beginning to, now the cold is beginning to grind us down. And my wife misses her family. She's close with her relatives. So we'd like to head back out west at some point. So we're looking. But my daughter just started her freshman year at the University of Minnesota. So when she finishes, I think we're going to take off. Mm-hmm. But we don't know where we're going to go. Just don't know.
So with Vine's books, what are some of the theories or, you know, just things that stick out to you most in mm-hmm. any of his books? Like what really stuck with you and that you carry with you?
That's a good question. Vine, as I was saying yesterday in my talk about him, he was the most brilliant man I've ever known. And he was curious about everything. And he wrote about everything. You know, most human beings' mind seems like it can only handle so much, even though we sort of self-limit ourselves. And any human being can really write about anything if they apply themselves. And Vine did. But, you know, for me, I've always been interested in politics, law, and history. Those are my three main fields. And, in fact, when people ask me, they know that I got my PhD in political science. And so they say, you're a political scientist. I say, no, I'm a polygalorian. I study politics, law, and history in roughly equal parts. So that's what I do. And so that's the work that Vine and I did together. And so when I read his, I read everything that he writes and or wrote. But I'm always looking for the political and the legal angle, because that's what really turns me on and gets me excited. And so just the way he described our governments and the way he emphasized the term tribal sovereignty, the way he emphasized the term self-determination, the way he reminded us that we were nations and not just ethnic groups, see? And the way that he was always reminding folks that we were the original peoples here and therefore we are the senior sovereigns. See, the federal government and even states like Minnesota and Washington act like they're somehow older than we are as governments, and they're not. They're babies. We've been around for thousands and thousands of years. And so with that accumulated knowledge and that sheer history gives us an understanding of the earth and institutions and everything that is superior. And you saw some of that in the clip. Did you watch the video clip yesterday?
Yeah.
I mean, my God, you know, he was slinging it out right there. And so it's that really helped me. In fact, I did a little article about him for a book that Steve Pavlik and Dan Wildcat edited. And I talk about the DeLorean trilogy, sacred space and place. You know, for us, it's all about our land. It's the way he understood and articulated the concept of sovereignty, which is, you know, our cultural identity and integrity and how we engage that and use that to guide us with our political and economic and legal decisions. And then this notion of self-determination, that we shouldn't wait for anybody to do anything for us, we should do it ourselves. Be a self-determined individual and be a self-determined nation, and you can accomplish anything. And so that DeLorean trilogy for me has really guided me in a lot of my work. And most of my work, written work, really focuses on, like I say, tribal government and tribal politics and federal Indian policy and federal Indian law. But it all really always comes back to those three major sort of concepts. And those continue to guide me in a lot of what I do.
here at the symposium, I feel like there's a lot of people who read his books and were touched in their own ways and agree with a lot of things that Fine says. And he just sounds really intense. And I never read his books before.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he just seems like a really big role model to a lot of people. And it brought so many people together here. It's
right.
just so...
Mm-hmm.
It makes me feel... To me, it makes me feel kind of whole to hear
mm-hmm.
everyone just be able to share their stories and how they're inspired by
mm-hmm.
Vine.
The same way. I mean, Vine really was a magnet in a sense, you know. I mean, you were just naturally drawn to him like a moth is drawn to a flame, you know, because there is a brilliance about him. And I mean, he's Lakota, so there is, you know, a touch of arrogance there, but a good kind of arrogance, not a kind of arrogance that in which he would elevate himself above anybody, because he never did that. He never thought that he was better than anybody, you know. But he knew that he was smart, and he demanded that individuals who studied with him or wanted to be around him engaged in the exercise of wanting to learn. And so he never accepted that, oh, I can't handle that or I can't do that. In fact, my first year studying with him in 1980 at the University of Arizona, I signed up for a course on Indian treaties that he was offering. And he said, Mr. Wilkins, you sure you want to take this course? This is a PhD level course and you're just a master's student. I said, I'm here to take every course that you offer, Professor DeLoria. I want to learn everything from you. He said, all right, come on in. I go into that class, and there were about 15 people. They were all PhD students. I think I was the only master's student, me and one other guy. And he handed out the syllabus, and it was about, you know, 25 pages thick. Talk about amount of reading, just a stunning amount of work that he expected us to do. We were to write 3 25-page term papers in that class. The most I'd ever written was 1 25-page term paper for a single class, and we had to do 3 for one class. And so I literally lived in the library, and that's all I did was study. The other two classes I had were like cupcakes compared to my DeLoria's class. And I had never been that challenged by anybody and so excited at the same time, see. And he really expected the native students that were in there to get it on, see. And he knew that we were capable of doing that. A lot of us had never been pushed that hard, see. And so he was always pushing us to explore our own depths and to never take no for an answer, see. And so when I got through that course, and I just barely made it through by the tip of my fingertips, I was so proud and I was so happy and so exhausted, you know. But I said, my God, if I can do this, I can do anything. And I always remind my students of that course. And I said, you know, Vine always set a high standard, a high bar for everybody that he associated with. And he never accepted incompetence. He never accepted excuses. He wanted us all to bust our tails for the people, for the land, for the environment, for the species that we're connected to. And if you didn't want to do that, he didn't want to hang around you, you know. He wanted people to engage in the real world problems that we were all confronted by and to do what needed to be done to make things happen. Yeah.
So powerful. I don't know, I just had a really rough year. I just graduated and I started working here at the service learning. And the last class I took was environmental science. So in reading that book and going chapter by chapter, I pretty much lived in the library too.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like constantly, I was amazed at how environmental science was so like, there's so many different aspects. And the way that they explained it just made it feel like we have to save the world or something, like do something right now. I considered a lot of changes in my life, like, but then I'll go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, just as a young student, seeing how this conscious sort of was brought to Indian country through a lot of things that he's done in his lifetime and a lot of things that he said. It's just really moving to me. And
you see, one of the strengths of Vine is that he never, you see sometimes, and this happens a lot in Indian country, and it happens a lot in the larger society as well, people look to their leaders and they just sort of expect their leaders to do everything for them, see. And Vine, he really kind of, he refused to be put on a pedestal, see. He was willing to work with anybody, but he would want to put people together in a room and say, okay, what are we going to do? You know, and of course, Indian country, we really drained Vine DeLoria. We used him up, I think, just like we use up our holy people, our medicine people, which is why many of them die young, you know. Because as Native peoples, we become over-dependent on our holy people, on our spiritual people, on our educational leaders of the magnitude of Vine, see. And that's not right, because historically, we certainly had chiefs and we had individuals who had leadership positions, but in the community, everyone was a sovereign individual. And every individual took their responsibilities and their roles seriously. And they didn't, you know, put all their faith into a single Messiah to save them, see. And Vine was always reminding us, you know, don't put me up there, you know, because I'm right here with you. I'm walking on the same ground with you. And together we can collaborate and address problems, but don't expect me to do it for you. And yet, of course, tribe would call him all hours of the night. Vine, come bail us out. Save us. Do this. Do that. Do that. So after he passed away, I wrote a column for Indian Country Today in which I said, we all contributed to his death, see, because we used him up, you know, because he was always responding to our needs when he had needs of his own, see. And so I feel bad about that. And yet, you know, Vine never stopped providing the help when he was asked, because that's what, you know, true leaders do. And yet, he was always reminding us that we all have to do our part and to not engage in hero worship or cult worship or follow the cult of personality, but to really develop your own personality, find what you do best, and then go do it, you know, and link up with other people who share interests, who share passions, and you can accomplish anything.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there's a sort of collective thinking when I'm in the, well, during the symposium. I just kind of felt that. And, like, we're all supposed to be there, you know. And and we all have our different roles in being there, you know. And I really appreciate that when it's like no one's a stranger, you know. And for me, when I take that, when I'm in those kind of environments, I just feel really responsible for my family. The second oldest of six, and I never want to just go too far ahead. I want to stay ahead, and be a good example, but I always want to take it home to them.
Right.
I told my mom, I was like, well, I graduated, and I'm thinking about going to a university out of state here in Montana or Mexico, and I told her about the symposium and how I've just been really gaining a lot and meeting people and hearing cool philosophies and theories that, you know, is just really helping things come together for me and in my journey and education. And but that's one thing I never want to do is forget my family, you know. And I'm definitely going to continue to share these kinds of things with my family, and that's how I'm going to be able to apply, you know, that collective, you know, thoughts and feelings from places like this. And I just want to thank you for all the work that you've done. And My prayers will be with you and your family and whoever else you come in contact with, because I think it's great to just sit here with you. And
and the pleasure's all mine. I love talking to, you know, students like yourself who are engaged, who are continuing to learn and continuing to grow and continue to expand your mind, and because that's what it takes. I mean, each generation, it falls upon the shoulder of each generation to make sure that the next generation has something to engage in, and that's the real strength of our peoples. In fact, I was talking to a young student yesterday. We were sitting out on the picnic table, and we were talking about some of these same issues, and she brought this concept of seven generations, which you probably heard about before. And I know some people say that, in fact, most people say that the seven generations mean that we're supposed to act in a way and we're supposed to think how it's going to impact seven generations down the road. And, well, I don't know about that. Vine wrote a piece one time in which he said, no, he said what he thought that meant was, it's like, I'm right here right now. I have parents and I had grandparents and great-grandparents. And then there's me, and I'm the fourth generation. And then I have a son. Eventually that son is going to have children, I hope. And then they're going to have children. That's seven generations right there, see. And that's a more manageable, more realistic understanding. So we want to act in a way that's going to reflect and show honor to our ancestors, you know, our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents. Not to some distant past. You know, who thinks 10,000 years in the past? You don't think that. But you know you have an immediate connection with those three generations before you. And you know that you have an impact and responsibility to those who are with you now and to your son and to your son's children and for the next generation beyond that. So that's a nice collective, comprehensive, you know, set of responsibilities and relationships and roles that I think, you know, is a wonderful guide map. And there's something else, you know, fine. In one of his works, talked about Einstein's theory of relativity, which I don't understand, by the way, but finds that's interesting and all. But he said, for Aboriginal peoples, for Native peoples, we had a theory of relatedness. And that's when he talked about the seven generations concept. And he said, that's a more profound theory, because if we understand this theory of relatedness and how we're all connected, we're going to engage in activities and make decisions that reflect positively both on the past, the present, and the future. And that's all we can do, I think. Yeah.
And thanks again.
Thank you very much.
I think that I want to say one more thing. And something that I gained, and you could also share something if you feel. When Albert Whitehead was talking about when he's 12, you know, and mm-hmm. his mom kind of gave him a foundation. Sometimes that, you know, in our own lifestyles and backgrounds and things like that, I think that it really helped me just kind of remember those kinds of things, because, you know, I'm growing, but remembering who I am is also important. Mm-hmm. And then just being able to continue to have that kind of foundation for me in education, and it's places and environments the symposium or other conferences that really I feel like I really get a lot of learning out of, and it's really where it kind of makes everything come in full circle. Mm-hmm. Every conference I go to, I don't know, it's just like that when there's so many people there and so many different stories are shared from where they come from, and it's just amazing to just be a part of that.
Right. But there's something about this conference, you know, because it's focused on a man, but more importantly, on a set of ideas and principles and values, you know, that Vine worked to enhance and to strengthen, that are all rooted in our own people's knowledge and our connection to the earth, see. And there's no other conference like this one, you know. And so this is the one I attend every year, gladly and happily. And I come at the beginning, early at the beginning, I stay until the end, because, you know, most of the people that come here share that same kind of sentiment. And so, you know, we're here to reflect and honor Vine, but more importantly, and Vine would insist on this, it's not about Vine, it's ultimately about those values and those knowledges of our own ancestors from every tribe in the world, because Native people live all over the globe, don't we? And we're all linked in fundamental ways, and it's about respecting those and letting those guide us in decisions that we need to make for our families and for our relatives and for the earth and for all the species. So thank you very much, young lady.